pinwheels, and an American flag made of Roman candles. But now they have canceled the fireworks. And no matter what anyone says, Marty feels that it is really the Fourth itself, his Fourth, that they have done to death. Only his Uncle Al, who blew into town late this morning to have the traditional salmon and fresh peas with the family, had understood. He had listened closely, standing on the veranda tiles in his dripping bathing suit. The others were swimming and laughing in the Coast Law's new pool on the other side of the house after lunch. Marty finished and looked at Uncle Al anxiously. "Do you see what I mean? Do you get it? It hasn't got anything to do with being crippled, like Katie says, or getting the fireworks all mixed up with America, like Grandpa thinks. It's just not right. When you look forward to something for so long, it's not right for Victor Bull and some dumb town council to come along and take it away. Not when it's something you really need. Do you get it?" There was a long, agonizing pause while Uncle Al considered Marty's question. Time enough for Marty to hear the kick-rattle of the diving board at the deep end of the pool, followed by Dad's hearty bellow, "Looking good, Kate! Hey, hey, looking real good!" Then Uncle Al said quietly, "Sure, I get it. And I got something for you, too, I think. Maybe you can make your own Fourth."
"My own Fourth? What do you mean?"
"Come on out to my car, Marty. I've got something." "Well, I'll show you." And he was striding away along the concrete path that circled the house before Marty could ask him what he meant. His wheelchair hummed along the path to the driveway, away from the sounds of the pool, splashes, laughing screams, the ka-thum of the diving board, away from his father's booming Big Pal voice. The sound of his wheelchair was a low, steady hum that Marty barely heard. All his life, that sound and the clank of his braces had been the music of his movement. Uncle Al's car was a low-slung Mercedes convertible. Marty knew his parents disapproved of it. $28,000 death trap, his mother had once called it with a brusque little sniff. But Marty loved it. Once, Uncle Al had taken him for a ride on some of the back roads that crisscrossed Tarker's Mills, and he had driven fast, 70, maybe 80. He wouldn't tell Marty how fast they were going. "If you don't know, you won't be scared," he had said. But Marty hadn't been scared. His belly had been sore the next day from laughing. Uncle Al took something out of the glove compartment of his car, and as Marty rolled up and stopped, he put a bulky cellophane package on the boy's withered thighs. "Here you go, kid," he said. "Happy 4th of July. The first thing Marty saw were exotic Chinese markings on the package's label. Then he saw what was inside, and his heart seemed to squeeze up in his chest. The cellophane package was full of fireworks. "The ones that look like pyramids are Twizzers," Uncle Al said. Marty, absolutely stunned with joy, moved his lips to speak, but nothing came out. "Light the fuses, set them down, and they spray as many colors as there are on a dragon's breath. The tubes with the thin sticks coming out of them are bottle rockets. Put them in an empty Coke bottle and up they go. The little ones are fountains. There are 2 Roman candles, and of course a package of firecrackers. But you better set those off tomorrow." Uncle Al cast an eye toward the noises coming from the pool.
"Thank you," Marty was finally able to gasp. "Thank you, Uncle Al."
"Just keep mum about where you got them," Uncle Al said. "A nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse, right?"
"Right, right,"
Marty babbled, although he had no idea what nods, winks, and blind horses had to do with fireworks.
"But are you sure you don't want them, Uncle Al?"
"I can get more," Uncle Al said. "I know a guy over in Bridgeton. He'll be doing business until it gets dark." He put a hand on Marty's head. "You keep your Fourth after everyone else goes to bed. Don't shoot off any of the noisy ones and wake them all up. And for Christ's sake, Don't blow your hand off, or my big sis will never speak to me again. Then Uncle Al laughed and climbed into his car and roared the engine into life. He raised his hand in a half-salute to Marty and then was gone while Marty was still trying to stutter his thanks. He sat there for a moment, looking after his uncle, swallowing hard to keep from crying. Then he put the packet of fireworks into his shirt and buzzed back to the house and his room. In his mind, he was already waiting for night to come and everyone to be asleep. He is the first one in bed that night. His mother comes in and kisses him goodnight, brusquely, not looking at his stick-like legs under the sheet. "You okay, Marty?" "Yes, Mom." She pauses, as if to say something more, and then gives her head a little shake. She leaves. His sister Kate comes in. She doesn't kiss him, merely leans her head close to his neck so he can smell the chlorine in her hair, and she whispers, "See? You don't always get what you want just because you're a cripple." "You might be surprised what I get," he says softly, and she regards him for a moment with narrow suspicion before going out. His father comes in last and sits on the side of Marty's bed. He speaks in his booming big pal voice. "Everything okay, big guy? You're off to bed early, real early."
"Just feeling a little tired, Daddy."
"Okay." He slaps one of Marty's wasted legs with his big hand, winces unconsciously, and then gets up in a hurry. "Sorry about the fireworks, but just wait till next year. Hey, hey, Rudy Patootie." Marty smiles a small, secret smile. So then he begins the waiting for the rest of the house to go to bed. It takes a long time. The TV runs on and on in the living room, the canned laugh tracks often augmented by Katie's shrill giggles. The toilet in Grandpa's bedroom goes with a bang and a flush. His mother chats on the phone, wishes someone a happy fourth, says yes, it was a shame the fireworks show had been canceled, but she thought that under the circumstances everyone understood why it had to be. Yes, Marty had been disappointed. Once near the end of her conversation, she laughs, and when she laughs, she doesn't sound a bit brusque. She hardly ever laughs around Marty. Every now and then, as 7:30 became 8 and 9, his hand creeps under his pillow to make sure the cellophane bag of fireworks is still there. Around 9:30, when the moon gets high enough to peer into his window and flood his room with silvery light, the house finally begins to wind down. The TV clicks off. Katie goes to bed, protesting that all her friends got to stay up late in the summer. After she's gone, Marty's folks sit in the parlor a while longer, their conversation only murmurs. And maybe he slept, because when he next touches the wonderful bag of fireworks, he realizes that the house is totally still and the moon has become even brighter, bright enough to cast shadows. He takes the bag out along with the book of matches he found earlier. He tucks his pajama shirt into his pajama pants, drops both the bag and the matches into his shirt, and prepares to get out of bed. This is an operation for Marty, but not a painful one, as people sometimes seem to think. There is no feeling of any kind in his legs, so there can be no pain. He grips the headboard of the bed, pulls himself up to a sitting position, and then shifts his legs over the edge of the bed one by one. He does this one-handed, using his other hand to hold the rail, which begins at his bed and runs all the way around the room. Once he had tried moving his legs with both hands, and somersaulted helplessly head over heels onto the floor. The crash brought everyone running. "You stupid show-off," Kate had whispered fiercely into his ear after he had been helped into his chair, a little shaken up but laughing crazily in spite of the swelling on one temple and his split lip. "You want to kill yourself, huh?" And then she had run out of the room crying. Once he's sitting on the edge of the bed, he wipes his hands on the front of his shirt to make sure they're dry and won't slip. Then he uses the rail to go hand over hand to his wheelchair. His useless scarecrow legs, so much dead weight, drag along behind him. The moonlight is bright enough to cast his shadow bright and crisp on the floor ahead of him. His wheelchair is on the brake, and he swings into it with confident ease. He pauses for a moment, catching his breath, listening to the silence of the house. "Don't shoot off any of the noisy ones tonight," Uncle Al had said, and listening to the silence, Marty knows that was right. He will keep his fourth by himself and to himself, and no one will know. At least not until tomorrow, when they see the blackened husks of the Twizzers and the fountains out on the veranda. And then it wouldn't matter. "As many colors as there are on a dragon's breath," Uncle Al had said. But Marty supposes there's no law against a dragon breathing silently. He lets the brake off his chair and flips the power switch. The little amber eye, the one that means his battery is well charged, comes on in the dark. Marty pushes right turn. The chair rotates right. Hey, hey! When it is facing the veranda doors, he pushes forward. The chair rolls forward, humming quietly. Marty slips the latch on the double doors, pushes forward again, and rolls outside. He tears open the wonderful bag of fireworks and then pauses for a moment, captivated by the summer night, the somnolent chirr of the crickets, the low, fragrant breeze that barely stirs the leaves of the trees at the edge of the woods, the almost unearthly radiance of the moon. He can wait no longer. He brings out a snake, strikes a match, lights its fuse, and watches in entranced silence as it splutters green-blue fire and grows magically, writhing and spitting flame from its tail. "The fourth," he thinks, his eyes alight. "The fourth, the fourth. Happy 4th of July to me." The snake's bright flame gutters low, flickers, goes out. Marty lights one of the triangular Twizzers and watches as it spouts fire as yellow as his dad's lucky golf shirt. Before it can go out, he lights a second that shoots off light as dusky red as the roses which grow beside the picket fence around the new pool. Now a wonderful smell of spent powder fills the night for the wind to rafter and pull slowly away. His groping hands pull out the flat packet of firecrackers next, and he has opened them before he realizes that to light these would be calamity. Their jumping, snapping, machine-gun roar would wake the whole neighborhood. Fire, flood, alarm, excursion. All of those. And 1 10-year-old boy named Martin Coleslaw in the doghouse until Christmas, most likely. He pushes the black cats further up on his lap, gropes happily in the bag again, and comes out with the biggest Twizzer of all. A world-class Twizzer, if ever there was one. It is almost as big as his closed fist. He lights it with mixed fright and delight and tosses it. Red light as bright as hellfire fills the night, and it is by this shifting, feverish glow that Marty sees the bushes at the fringe of the woods below the veranda shake and part. There is a low noise, half cough, half snarl. The beast appears. It stands for a moment at the base of the lawn and seems to scent the air, and then it begins to shamble up the slope toward where Marty sits on the slate flagstones in his wheelchair, his eyes bulging, his upper body shrinking against the canvas back of his chair. The beast is hunched over, but it is clearly walking on its two rear legs, walking the way a man would walk. The red light of the Twizzer skates hellishly across its green eyes. It moves slowly, its wide nostrils flaring rhythmically, scenting prey, almost surely scenting that prey's weakness. Marty can smell it, its hair, its sweat, its savagery. It grunts again, Its thick upper lip, the color of liver, wrinkles back to show its heavy, tusk-like teeth. Its pelt is painted a dull, silvery red. It has almost reached him. Its clawed hands, so like unlike human hands, reaching for his throat, when the boy remembers the packet of firecrackers. Hardly aware he is going to do it, he strikes a match and touches it to the master fuse. The fuse spits a hot line of red sparks that singe the fine hair on the back of his hand, crisping them. The werewolf, momentarily off balance, draws backwards, uttering a questioning grunt that, like his hands, is nearly human. Marty throws the packet of firecrackers in its face. They go off in a banging, flashing train of light and sound. The beast utters a screech roar of pain and rage. It staggers backwards, clawing at the explosions that tattoo grains of fire and burning gunpowder into its face. Marty sees one of its lamp-like green eyes whiff out as four crackers go off at once with a terrific thundering kapow at the side of its muzzle. Now its screams are pure agony. It claws at its face, bellowing, and as the first lights go on in the coleslaw house, it turns and bounds back down the lawn toward the woods, leaving behind it only a smell of singed fur and the first frightened and bewildered cries from the house.
"What was that?"
his mother's voice, not sounding a bit brusque.
"Who's there, goddammit?"
his father, not sounding very much like a big pal.
"Marty?"
Kate, her voice quavering, not sounding mean at all.
"Marty, are you all right?"
Grandfather Coleslaw sleeps through the whole thing. Marty leans back in his wheelchair as the big red twizzer gutters its way to extinction. Its light is now the mild and lovely pink of an early sunrise. He is too shocked to weep, but his shock is not entirely a dark emotion, although the next day his parents will bundle him off to visit his Uncle Jim and Aunt Ida over in Stowe, Vermont, where he will stay until the end of summer vacation. The police concur. They feel that the full moon killer might try to attack Marty again and silence him. There is a deep exultation in him. It is stronger than the shock. He has looked into the terrible face of the beast and lived. And there is simple, childlike joy in him as well, a quiet joy he will never be able to communicate later to anyone, not even Uncle Al, who might have understood. He feels this joy because the fireworks have happened after all. And while his parents stewed and wondered about his psyche, and if he would have complexes from the experience, Marty Coleslaw came to believe in his heart that it had been the best Fourth of all. August.
"Sure, I think it's a werewolf," Constable Neary says.
He speaks too loudly, maybe accidentally, more like accidentally on purpose, and all conversation in Stan's barbershop comes to a halt. It is going on just 5:30 August, the hottest August anyone can remember in Tarker's Mills for years, and tonight the moon will be just one day past full. So the town holds its breath, waiting. Constable Neary surveys his audience and then goes on from his place in Stan Pelkey's middle barber chair, speaking weightily, speaking judicially, speaking psychologically, all from the depths of his high school education. Neary is a big, beefy man, and in high school he mostly made touchdowns for the Tarker's Mills Tigers. His classwork earned him some C's and not a few D's.
"There are guys," he tells them, "who are kind of like two people, kind of like split personalities, you know. They are what I'd call fucking schizos."
He pauses to appreciate the respectful silence which greets this, and then goes on.
"Now this guy, I think he's like that. I don't think he knows what he's doing when the moon gets full and he goes out and kills somebody. He could be anybody, a teller at the bank, a gas jockey at one of those stations out on the town road, maybe even someone right here now, in the sense of being an animal inside and looking perfectly normal outside, yeah, you bet. But if you mean, do I think there's a guy who sprouts hair and howls at the moon, no. That shit's for kids.
What about the coleslaw boy, Neary? Stan asks, continuing to work carefully around the roll of fat at the base of Neary's neck. His long, sharp scissors go snip, snip, snip.
Just proves what I said, Neary responds with some exasperation. That shit's for kids. In truth, he feels exasperated about what's happened with Marty Coleslaw. Here, in this boy, is the first eyeball witness to this freak that's killed 6 people in his town, including Neary's good friend, Alfie Knopfler. And is he allowed to interview the boy? No. Does he even know where the boy is? No. He's had to make do with a deposition furnished to him by the state police, and he had to bow and scrape and just a damn bout beg to get that much. All because he's a small-town constable, what the state police think of as a kiddie cop, not able to tie his own shoes. All because he doesn't have one of their numbfuck Smokey Bear hats. And the deposition. He might as well have used it to wipe his ass with. According to the Coleslaw kid, this beast stood about 7 feet tall, was naked, was covered with dark hair all over his body. He had big teeth and green eyes and smelled like a load of panther shit. He had claws, but the claws looked like hands. He thought it had a tail. A tail, for Christ's sake. Maybe, Kenny Franklin says from his place in the row of chairs along the wall, maybe it's some kind of disguise this fella puts on. Like a mask and all, you know? I don't believe it, Neary says emphatically, and nods his head to emphasize the point. Stan has to draw his scissors back in a hurry to avoid putting one of the blades into that beefy roll of fat at the back of Neary's neck. No, sir, I don't believe it. Kid heard a lot of these werewolf stories at school before it closed for the summer. He admitted as much. And then he didn't have nothing to do but sit there in that chair of his and think about it, work it over in his mind. It's all psycho-fucking-logical, you see. Why, if it had been you that had come out of the bushes by the light of the moon, he would have thought you was a wolf, Kenny. Kenny laughs a little uneasily. Nope, Neary says gloomily. Kid's testimony is just no damn good at all. In his disgust and disappointment over the deposition taken from Marty Coleslaw at the home of Marty's aunt and uncle in Stowe, Constable Neary had also overlooked this line. 4 of them went off at the side of his face. I guess you'd call it a face, all at once, and I guess maybe it put his eye out. His left eye. If Constable Neary had chewed this over in his mind, and he hadn't, he would have laughed even more contemptuously, because in that hot, still August of 1984, there was only one townsperson sporting an eye patch, and it was simply impossible to think of that person of all persons being the killer. Neary would have believed his mother the killer before he would have believed that. There's only one thing that'll solve this case, Constable Neary says, jabbing his finger at the 4 or 5 men sitting against the wall and waiting for their Saturday morning haircuts. And that's good police work, and I intend to be the guy who does it. Those state smokies are going to be laughing on the other side of their faces when I bring the guy in. Neary's face turns dreamy. Anyone, he says. A bank teller, gas jockey, just some guy you drink with down there at the bar. But good police work will solve it, you mark my words. But Constable Lander Neary's good police work comes to an end that night, when a hairy, moon-silvered arm reaches through the open window of his Dodge pickup as he sits parked at the crossing point of 2 dirt roads out in West Tarker's Mills. There is a low, snorting grunt and a wild, terrifying smell, like something you would smell in the lion house of a zoo. His head is snapped around,
and he stares into one green eye. He sees the fur, the black, damp-looking snout, and when the snout wrinkles back, he sees the teeth. The beast claws at him almost playfully, and one of his cheeks is ripped away in a flap, exposing his teeth on the right side. Blood spouts everywhere. He can feel it running down over the shoulder of his shirt, sinking in warmly. He screams. He screams out of his mouth and out of his cheek. Over the beast's working shoulders, he can see the moon flooding down white light. He forgets all about his 30-30 and the 45 strapped on his belt. He forgets all about how this thing is psycho-fucking-logical. He forgets all about good police work. Instead, his mind fixes on something Kenny Franklin said in the barbershop that morning. Maybe it's some kind of disguise this fella puts on, like a mask and all, you know? And so, as the werewolf reaches for Neri's throat, Neri reaches for its face, grabs double handfuls of coarse wiry fur, and pulls, hoping madly that the mask will shift and then pull off. There will be the snap of an elastic, the liquid ripping sound of latex, and he will see the killer. But nothing happens. Nothing except a roar of pain and rage from the beast. It swipes at him with one clawed hand. Yes, he can see it is a hand, however hideously misshapen. A hand, the boy was right, and lays his throat wide open. Blood jets over the truck's windshield and dashboard. It drips into the bottle of bush that has been sitting tilted against Constable Neri's crotch. The werewolf's other hand snags in Neri's freshly cut hair and yanks him half out of the Ford pickup's cab. It howls once in triumph, and then it buries its face and snout in Neri's neck. It feeds while the beer gurgles out of the spilled bottle and foams on the floor by the truck's brake and clutch pedals. So much for psychology. So much for good police work. September. As the month wears on, and the night of the full moon approaches again, the frightened people of Tarker's Mills wait for a break in the heat, but no such break comes. Elsewhere in the wider world, the baseball divisional races are decided one by one, and the football exhibition season has begun. In the Canadian Rockies, jolly old Willard Scott informs the people of Tarker's Mills a foot of snow falls on the 21st of September. But in this corner of the world, summer hangs right in there. Temperatures linger in the 80s during the days. Kids, 3 weeks back in school, and not happy to be there, sit and swelter in droning classrooms where the clocks seem to have been set to click only 1 minute forward for each hour which passes in real time. Husbands and wives argue viciously for no reason, and at O'Neill's Gulf Station out on Town Road by the entrance to the turnpike, a tourist starts giving Pucky O'Neill some lip about the price of gas, and Pucky brains the fellow with the gas pump nozzle. The fellow, who is from New Jersey, needs 4 stitches in his upper lip and goes away muttering balefully under his breath about lawsuits and subpoenas. "I don't know what he's bitching about," Pucky says sullenly that night in the pub. "I only hit him with half of my force, you know. If I'd have hit him with all my force, I would have knocked his frockin' smart mouth right the frock off, you know." "Sure," Billy Robertson says, because Pucky looks like he may hit him with all his force if he disagrees. "How about another beer, Puck?" "You're frockin' A," Pucky says. Milt Sturmfuller puts his wife in the hospital over a bit of egg that the dishwasher didn't take off one of the plates. He takes one look at that dried yellow smear on the plate she tried to give him for his lunch and pounds her a good one. As Pucky O'Neill would have said, Milt hits her with all his force. "Damn slutty bitch," he says, standing over Donna Lee, who is sprawled out on the kitchen floor, her nose broken and bleeding, the back of her head also bleeding.
My mother used to get the dishes clean, and she didn't have no dishwasher either. What's the matter with you?
Later, Milt will tell the doctor at the Portland General Hospital emergency room that Donna Lee fell down the back stairs. Donna Lee, terrorized and cowed after 9 years in a marital war zone, will back this up. Around 7 o'clock on the night of the full moon, a wind springs up, the first chill wind of that long summer season. It brings a rack of clouds from the north, and for a while the moon plays tag with these clouds, ducking in and out of them, turning their edges to beaten silver. Then the clouds grow thicker and the moon disappears, yet it is there. The tides 20 miles out of Tarker's Mills feel its pull, and so, closer to home, does the beast. Around 2 in the morning, a dreadful squealing arises from the pig pen of Elmer Zinneman on the West Stage Road, about 12 miles out of town. Elmer goes for his rifle, wearing only his pajama pants and his slippers. His wife, who was almost pretty when Elmer married her at 16 in 1947, pleads and begs and cries, wanting him to stay with her, wanting him not to go out. Elmer shakes her off and grabs his gun from the entryway. His pigs are not just squealing, they are screaming. They sound like a bunch of very young girls surprised by a maniac at a slumber party. He is going. Nothing can make him not go, he tells her, and then freezes with one work-calloused hand on the latch of the back door as a screaming howl of triumph rises in the night. It is a wolf cry, but there is something so human in the howl that it makes his hand drop from the latch, and he allows Alice Zinneman to pull him back into the living room. He puts his arms around her and draws her down onto the sofa, and there they sit like two frightened children. Now the crying of the pigs begins to falter and stop. Yes, they stop. One by one, they stop. Their squeals die in hoarse, bloody, gargling sounds. The beast howls again, its cry as silver as the moon. Elmer goes to the window and sees something, he cannot tell what, go bounding off into the deeper darkness. The rain comes later, pelting against the windows as Elmer and Alice sit up in bed together, all the lights in the bedroom on. It is a cold rain, the first real rain of the autumn, and tomorrow the first tinge of color will have come into the leaves. Elmer finds what he expects in his pig pen. Carnage. All 9 of his sows and both of his boars are dead, disemboweled and partly eaten. They lie in the mud, the cold rain pelting down on their carcasses, their bulging eyes staring up at the cold autumn sky. Elmer's brother, Pete, called over from Minot, stands beside Elmer. They don't speak for a long time, and then Elmer says what has been in Pete's mind as well.
Insurance will cover some of it. Not all, but some. I guess I can foot the rest. Better my pigs than another person.
Pete nods.
There's been enough, he says,
his voice a murmur that can barely be heard over the rain.
What do you mean? You know what I mean. Next full moon, there's got to be 40 men out, or 60, or 160. Time folks stopped dicking around and pretending it ain't happening, when any fool can see it is. Look here, for Christ's sweet sake.
Pete points down. Around the slaughtered pigs, the soft earth of the pen is full of very large tracks. They look like the tracks of a wolf, but they also look weirdly human.
You see those fucking tracks?
I see them, Elmer allows.
You think Sweet Betsy from Pike made those tracks?
No, I guess not.
Werewolf made those tracks, Pete says. You know it. Alice knows it. Most of the people in this town know it. Hell, even I know it. And I come from the next county over.
He looks at his brother, his face dour and stern, the face of a New England Puritan from 1650, and he repeats,
"There's been enough. Time this thing was ended."
Elmer considers this long as the rain continues to tap on the two men's slickers, and then he nods.
"I guess. But not next full moon."
"You want to wait until November?"
Elmer nods.
"Bare woods, better tracking, if we get a little snow."
"What about next month?"
Elmer Zinneman looks at his slaughtered pigs in the pen beside his barn. Then he looks at his brother Pete.
"People better look out," he says.
October. When Marty Koslaw comes home from trick-or-treating on Halloween night, with the batteries in his wheelchair all but dead flat, he goes directly to bed, where he lies awake until the half-moon rises in a cold sky strewn with stars like diamond chips. Outside on the veranda, where his life was saved by a string of 4th of July firecrackers, a chill wind blows brown leaves in swirling, aimless corkscrews on the flagstones. They rattle like old bones. The October full moon has come and gone in Tarker's Mills with no new murder. The second month in a row this has happened. Some of the townspeople, Stan Pelkey, the barber, is one, and Cal Blodwin, who owns Blodwin Chevrolet, the town's only car dealership, is another, believe that the terror is over. The killer was a drifter, or a tramp living out in the woods, and now he has moved on, just as they said he would. Others, however, are not so sure. These are the ones who do long reckoning on the 4 deer found slaughtered out by the turnpike the day after the October full moon, and upon Elmer Zinneman's 11 pigs killed at full moon time in September. The argument rages at the pub over beers during the long autumn nights. But Marty Koslaw knows. This night he has gone out trick-or-treating with his father. His father likes Halloween, likes the brisk cold, likes to laugh his hearty big pal laugh and bellow such idiotic things as "Hey, hey!" and "Ring, dang, do!" when the doors open and familiar Tarker's Mills faces look out. Marty went as Yoda, a big rubber Don Post mask pulled down over his head, and a voluminous robe on which covered his wasted legs. "You always get everything you want," Katie says with a toss of her head when she sees the mask. But he knows she isn't really mad at him, and as if to prove it, she makes him an artfully crooked Yoda staff to complete his get-up. But perhaps sad because she is now considered too old to go out trick-or-treating. Instead, she will go to a party with her junior high school friends. She will dance to Donna Summer records and bob for apples, and later on the lights will be turned down for a game of spin the bottle.